It is that this event did not occur by spontaneous nucleation. It was organized into existence by organizers who are Don Meroff, Henrietta Elbang, and Veronica Houbini. And they did not do it alone. They had help. They had a lot of help from a number of our UCSB graduate students, Netta Engelhart, Sebastian Fischetti, Eric Mefford, Will Kelly, Gavin Hartnett, Kevin Coons, Jason Ween, and Megan Leone. They also had help from staff members in the physics department, Shiloh Tucker and Anne Claire Kane. And here at the USEN, we've had the enormous help and support of the USEN event staff, the instructional development team that's providing the video, and last but not least, USEN Catering that provided all the food. And now we will begin the final session, starting with Sean Hartnell, who will tell us about entanglement entropy in two-dimensional string theory.
Thanks. So obviously it's an honor to be talking at Gary's birthday fest. So last night, Andy was saying how when he and Gary were writing the Clavial paper, that when they started, neither of them, they barely knew what a complex manifold was, let alone a Kähler manifold or a Chern class. I think that's quite an inspiring thing for, especially hopefully for a lot of graduate students or young physicists, that you don't have to know what you're doing to jump in. And my experience with Gary was definitely something analogous to that, and I'm pretty sure that when we started thinking about superconductors a few years ago now, neither of us barely knew what a superconductor was, and we sort of had this idea that we had to put some charged scalar hair on the black hole somehow, but exactly what it would do for us was, we didn't really know, but we had a sense that it might be a fun thing to do anyway. And so Andy, or maybe it was Gary, was saying how he went to the library to get some algebraic geometry textbook. And so similarly, a few years ago, Andy and I were walking around with copies of Tinkham, which is this superconductivity textbook. And this is not some fancy field theory, high-powered superconductivity textbook. This is really a nuts and bolts textbook written by an experimentalist. And so we were reading this book, and we get very excited every time we got a plot that looked like one of the plots in, that looked like one of the plots in the book, even if we didn't totally understand what the plots were of at that point. So hopefully we've learned a lot since then, and it's certainly been a great pleasure to embark on this adventure with Gary and all the other people who've been working on it with us. And so it would have been natural, this project is still very much ongoing. However, I saw Gary about a month ago in a conference in Cambridge, and I gave a talk about applied ADS CFT things. And I thought, because it's Gary's birthday, I should give him something new. So I decided to talk about this paper instead that came out just on Thursday. And I should also say that this project is also very much in the spirit of working on things that we don't understand fully. So I hope I don't say anything too wrong, but I think it's interesting. So I want to say a few words about entanglement in two-dimensional string theory. Okay, so the big picture is the following. Suppose, by Gary's 70th birthday, somebody, we're in a state where we can just give him, as a birthday present, the ground state of N equals 4 super young Mills. Just give him a disk drive or whatever it is that we have in 10 years' time. And you can open that on your quantum computer, and you just have the ground state of N equals 4 just there for you, okay? Now, in that ground state, we have good reason to believe that there should be an emergent space-time is hidden in that ground state. And then the question is, how would you find the emergent semi-classical space-time if somebody hands you the ground state wave function, okay? So the idea I have in mind, n equals 4 sub Young Mills, or maybe the BFSS, or whatever your favorite quantum mechanical theory is that's supposed to have an emergent spacetime. I really mean emergent space, but I'm gonna say spacetime. So of course, because along with the space, the causality structure and so on has to emerge as well. So the question I want to ask is how can we see, in principle, the emergent spacetime given a wave function of a non-gravitational theory? Okay, seems like an important question. In a very invariant way, I don't want to know what the matter is that's going to propagate on this spacetime. I just want to see the locality. So one way to phrase that question is that we'd like to see the fact that the low energy excitations of this theory will organize themselves into local quantum fields in whatever this emergent spacetime is, right? So, you know, the only reason we bother to talk about spacetime is that it constrains the interactions of fields that are propagating on the spacetime, okay? So from my point of view, identifying the emergent spacetime is equivalent to identifying the existence of local quantum fields propagating on that spacetime, okay? If the spacetime is too quantum or the fields are too non-local, that's no good, okay? That's not what we're interested in, all right? So how would we see in this wave function that the low energy degrees of freedom are described by local quantum fields in some emergent spacetime? Well, a nice way to think about it is in terms of entanglement entropy. So as Mark Chernicki and others taught us a little while ago now, one characteristic of local quantum field theories is that they have the low energy states of these theories have a large amount of short distance entanglements, okay? And so this is the statement that if you have your field theory on some space, you take some region A, that's this region, and then due to the short wavelength modes in the theory, there's gonna be a large amount of entanglement due to short distance modes that are crossing the boundary. And so in particular, if we have a sort of cutoff epsilon, a UV cutoff on the wave vector of the theory, that gives us a large contribution to the entanglement that diverges like 1 over epsilon to some power that depends on a dimension. In particular, if you're in 2 space-time dimensions, then there's a log epsilon divergence. So a natural idea is that if you're given the wave function, one way to see the emergent locality is to find this accumulation of entanglement that comes with the locality in the wave function, right? So can we find this accumulation of entanglement that we know has to exist, right? If there is a local emergent description, it will come with this area law entanglement, and we should be able to see that. So for example, n equals 4, there's an S5, there's local dynamics on the S5. If we start partitioning the matrices of n equals 4 in the right way, this is the 6 scalar matrices, we should see an area law entanglement of regions of the S5 in the wave function, okay? I'm not talking about entanglement in n equals 4, I'm talking about local entanglement in the emergent theory, right? So in the S5, for example. So just to be clear about what I'm talking about, in the first instance, I'm really thinking of the entanglement, just to be specific, of, let's say, the graviton propagating on the S5 in the space-time, okay? So I'm thinking about the entanglement of fields that are propagating in the bulk. In the first instance, I'm not thinking about what might be a deeper entanglement, which is this, you know, there are a lot of ideas, various versions of the idea out there that space-time is somehow held together by the entanglement of microscopic stringy degrees of freedom, okay? That's not what I'm talking about. That would be things that might underlie the Ruta-Akinaki formula. I'm just thinking of the entanglement of a scalar field or the graviton propagating on some semi-classical background, okay? However, as various papers, I guess going back to Suskin and Uglum, by these papers and many other people have suggested, there's not really a sharp distinction between these two things, right? That the quantum corrections to Ruta-Akinaki, so if I have a scalar field in the bulk that has some entanglement across the surface in the bulk, okay, and that you can think of that as a sort of one loop correction to Ruta-Akinaki. So there's not necessarily a sharp distinction in a full theory of quantum gravity between the deep stuff that's gluing together the space-time and the entanglement of fields propagating on the space-time. They may all come together, okay? So realizing this program of seeing the locality in the bulk in its full glory may well come together with a deep understanding of Ruta-Akinaki, okay? Good. So indeed, when I first started wondering about this, I thought, well, that's okay, let's start with BFSS and let's look at the wave function. But that's just crazy. I mean, even the fermionic, just the fermionic part of the wave function of BFSS is some huge dimensionality, okay, and it's not clear where to start. So then we said, well, maybe we should go to two major Cs instead of, you know, 10 or 8 or whatever it is, however many there are. And that would also seem difficult. So I wanted to start in the absolute simplest place where anything resembling this program might be possible to be carried out. And that seems to be, I think, the absolute simplest it could be, but still have some content, is two-dimensional string theory, which I knew literally nothing about a year ago. Okay, so so 2D string theory, let me tell you a little bit about it. So it's the baby cousin of ADS-CFT, meaning it has some of the structure, but it's a lot simpler. And there are really three, as in all of these dualities, there are really three perspectives. So there's the matrix quantum mechanics, that's like the field theory. There's this Einstein-Dilaton gravity, that's like the bulk. That's like, you know, 2B supergravity in ADS-CFT. And then there's the world sheet theory of the string in that describes this target space dynamics, okay? For what I'm going to have to do, we're not going to go via the top. So this is the sort of thing that glues these two together in the first instance. But we can just think of it as a version of ADS-CFT, where here, the theory, the quantum field theory is just this matrix quantum mechanics, where we have just time, and we have one n by n matrix with a action, something like this. And in the bulk, we have a two-dimensional space-time, and the fields are going to be the metric, a dilaton, and a tachyon, okay? Because it's two dimensions, most of these fields are not dynamical, and in fact, there's only one dynamical degree of freedom here, which is often thought of as the tachyon. I don't know who's responsible for this, but it's a massless field about the relevant background. So as written in the action, it's tachyonic, but the fluctuations about the linear dilaton background that we're going to come to are not tachyonic. The origins of this theory are so old from my point of view, I'm not even sure who to cite, but useful reviews that I learned stuff from by Klebanov, Ginsburg, Moore, and Polchinski. These are sort of the old 1990 reviews. Also, Martinek has a more recent review that I also found useful. Okay, so good. So that's the duality, right? And so the realization of the project that I mentioned is that I'd like to find some way of partitioning the Hilbert space of this theory so that we can see the emergent locality in this x direction in that theory, right? So we have this tachyon propagating on this background. It's going to have a lot of short distance entanglement, and we'd like to see that entanglement in the non-gravitational description, right? That's the idea. It's sort of sufficiently simple here that it's not surprising you can do it, but it's nice to see how it works out. Okay, so let me just tell you, I have one slide about each side of the duality. So on the target space, the space-time side, so the theory is this Einstein-Dilaton-Tachyon field theory. And so the background that one cares about, so the equivalent of ADS, if you like, is this linear dilaton background, which the metric is just flat space, the dilaton is linear in x, and there's also a tachyon profile that grows exponentially with x. And so the weak coupling regime is when x goes to minus, the string coupling is e to the phi, that goes like e to the 2x, and so it's weakly coupled over here on the left. So the picture you have the one-dimensional space-time. There's this tachyon wall that looks something like that, okay? And the tachyon basically cuts off the space-time. So you can sort of think there's nothing over there. And the dilaton is growing as you go along. So this bit is weakly coupled. Over here is strongly coupled. The solutions depend on one parameter mu, okay? And so this one parameter you have determines the string coupling at the tachyon wall, okay? So if mu is large, the string coupling at the wall is small. And then you can describe all of the space-time physics here within a weakly coupled regime of string theory. Okay, whilst if the coupling here was large, then processes that happen over here will be weakly interacting, but things that happen close to the wall would be strongly interacting. Okay, so mu, large mu, is weak string coupling in the whole space-time. And so the basic physics that people discussed in the 90s is that you take a tachyon, you shoot it in, and it bounces back, okay? That's the basic calculation that you do in this theory. Okay. The field theory, or the matrix quantum mechanics side of the duality, is you have this single matrix, and I'm just going to make things simple. I'm going to gauge the derivative. So this time derivative is actually gauged, and that means the only degrees of freedom in the theory are the eigenvalue. So there's just only one matrix, so you can just diagonalize it, okay? And then, so when you diagonalize the matrix, the theory that you're gonna get is describes n non-interacting fermions, so the eigenvalues turn out to be the van der Moen repulsion between the eigenvalues turns out to be equivalent to having a Fermi, a Pauli exclusion. So this single, this theory, if this time derivative is gauged, means that it's completely equivalent to, you diagonalize the matrix, you get n non-interacting fermions moving in some potential V of lambda, okay? So the, yeah, it's simple, okay? Okay, so this V of lambda could be sort of whatever you want, and then you have to take a certain scaling limit. So you're gonna take n to infinity, so you're taking a big matrix, a lot of fermions, and you zoom in, so of course the fermions fill up a Fermi C in this potential, and the limit you take is that you move the Fermi surface to be close to a maximum of the potential, okay? So that's this picture, your potential V has some maximum in it, and then you move, this is the Fermi level of all the fermions you filled up, and you move, you take some scaling limit where you take a lot of fermions, but you keep the distance, mu is the distance between the Fermi energy and the top of the potential, you keep that fixed, okay? But this is small in sort of n units. So you zoomed in to the max, to close to the maximum of the potential. And so what you're left with now is just fermions, a Fermi C in an upside down potential, okay? That's the field theory in this case. And so now the basic physics in this case is that you take your Fermi C and you just tap it a little bit and you create a density fluctuation, okay? And then these density fluctuations are ripples in the Fermi surface, and those will propagate back and forth, and in particular you could send in a ripple and then it bounces back again, okay? And so that's the basic fermionic physics that you want to study in this model, okay? So both sides of duality are fairly simple. And, oh yes, one thing we need to know is that this mu is the same as the other mu, okay? So the limit, so we're gonna go to the large, I want things to be as semi-classical as possible, you know, I want the space-time to be as semi-classical as possible, so I'm gonna take a large mu limit, which means the string coupling is small everywhere, and in that limit, on the fermion side, that's when you push this down, and that actually turns out to be a WKB limit in the wave functions. So morally, it's sort of obvious, the natural thing is that the way the duality works is that the space-time tachyon, this excitation that you can bounce off the walls, is basically a bosonization of the excitation of the fermions where you scatter this density fluctuation off the potential, okay? That's, right, there's a propagating mode, there's one propagating mode on both sides, and so they're sort of morally they're the same thing. There's a twist in this story, unfortunately, which is that on the string side, in addition to this tachyon, there are a tower of non-dispersing string states, okay, that are responsible for things called leg poles and so on, that mean that actually this map is not local, okay? One place you can read about it is in that paper. So this complication is not gonna show up in my story, and I suspect it is because these excited string states don't contribute very much to the entanglement entropy of a localized region in space, but I'm not sure. But so for the calculation I'm gonna do, this picture seems to work pretty well, okay? That I'm gonna want to identify, I wanna think about this density fluctuation as the tachyon that's bouncing off this wall, more or less. And so you can just do this. So you can take, so Javicki and Daz took this bosonized, it's a non-relativistic bosonization, okay? You just have this Fermi surface, you get some effective action for the collective density excitation, and you can map that onto the dynamics of a scalar field. All you have to do is make a certain coordinate transformation. So x is the distance, is this x, okay, it's the dimension, and lambda is this lambda, it's the direction along here, okay? So these density fluctuations satisfy a wave equation, a massless wave equation, if you use in x. So lambda, so this is called the time of flight variable. So lambda is a coordinate that the fermions see, and x is the coordinate that the tachyon sees, and modulo this complication, there's just a map between them, okay? in particular, when you're far out in that direction, x goes like minus log lambda. Okay? There's a minus sign because I put the tachyons on this side, and I put the fermions on this side for some reason. Good. And so in the large mu limit, you have weak string coupling, okay, in the bulk, and it turns out this is a WKB limit of the fermions, which you can sort of see here, right? This is like where the energy would appear in WKB, and large mu is like large energies. All right, so that's the setup, okay? So the field, the sort of matrix quantum mechanics is equivalent to these fermions, and we have a sort of map that takes it to the space-time. So let me just tell you, I'll flash our result, and then I'll spend a few minutes talking about how to get it. So firstly, what would you expect? So you have this tachyon, you have a massless field propagating in the bulk, in the emergent space-time. The tachyon is a massless field, and so the entanglement of some interval delta x, okay, you'd expect it to go like 1/3. This is like C over 3, okay? It's one massless field. The entanglement entropy of one massless field in a region delta x is well known from Wilczek and collaborators to be 1/3 times log of the distance and then some UV cutoff, okay? Now, if you did the space-time calculation, you'd have no idea what this cutoff is. This is some non-perturbative thing that you would not be able to access perturbatively from the space-time. Okay. So what we did is we take these free fermions moving in this upside-down potential, and we just calculated the entanglement entropy of the eigenvalues that are in some interval, lambda 1, lambda 2. Remember, lambda is the coordinate for the fermions. And the answer we found is 1/3 times a log times the distance in precisely this tau coordinate. Okay, remember, the tau coordinate is the one that, with respect to which, the density fluctuations obey a wave equation. Okay? So the distance in the tau coordinate, which is log of lambda, divided by, so we got, this is a manifestly finite answer, okay, there's no divergence, and the cutoff is this thing at the bottom, okay? And this is the string coupling divided by mu, the string coupling divided by mu at the two endpoints of the interval. That's exactly what you expect, actually. So this epsilon is really a square root of epsilon times a square root of epsilon, where 1/2 comes from each end of the interval, because there are two divergences, okay? And so if the UV cutoff in the theory is being set by the string coupling, which it is, then it's very, and the string coupling is space dependent, then this is exactly what you expect to find, that it's regularized differently at the two ends, okay? So I think this is just a natural normalization. So if the string at the wall is mu, so when I think you probably, this mu should have been absorbed into the definition of the string coupling. So if you set the string to 1 at the tachyon wall, then that mu wouldn't be there. So in particular, when it's weakly coupled everywhere in the bulk, this number is small everywhere in the bulk. And this is what comes out. It seems natural, but I don't have a deep explanation. And so two things about this formula. So I think this formula is quite nice. So this is what we're out to get, right? We partitioned some matrix quantum mechanics degrees of freedom, the eigenvalues, and we got precisely an accumulation of short distance entanglement, which is cut off by, well, I'm not exactly sure what the scale is in the bulk, but if we think of the following, McGreevy and Valinda, if we think of the space-time as some condensate of deep brains, this distance is something like the de Broglie wavelength of the deep brains. It's like there's some graininess of the space-time that's roughly set by the wavelength of the deep brains making up the space-time, but those are just words. Another second thing, actually, is that a sort of simplified version of this formula, but essentially in the same spirit, appeared in this paper by Daz. It seems to be completely unknown, actually. It has like 5 citations. It's basically a sort of simpler version of this, but it has the same idea that this cutoff is basically the depth of the Fermi C. Okay, so this Fermi C has a finite depth, there's a finite number of modes that are entangled, and that's where this cutoff comes from. Okay. So I just wanna, so this, right, I sort of see this as a proof of principle that this perspective can be realized. Okay, yes. Yeah. I'm about to tell you from the fermion side. I'm about to tell you right now. I'm going now. So this matrix quantum mechanics has in it enough entanglement to realize the expected locality of the tachyon. Okay, that's what this formula is showing you. And in addition, we get an explicit cutoff in terms of the strain coupling. All right. So I'm just going to show you an outline. I'm not going to do any calculations, but give you the logic whereby you calculate this. It's not totally trivial. And in particular, it depends on a few nice results that have been developed in the last decade for calculating the entanglement of free fermions. Okay. So firstly, if you think in a first quantized picture, it's easy to get confused about how to think about entanglement. So it's extremely useful to go to the second quantized description of the free fermions. So that you do as follows. So these would be nu is the energy, right? So for every nu, there's a wave function for fermion. You know, we're solving the Schrodinger equation, it's upside down potential, you get a bunch of scattering states. That's these guys. So that's the first quantized wave functions. Of course, they're a function. So the mod squared of this will give you the probability of finding an eigenvalue with value lambda, right? This is just a good old wave function. And you build a second quantized field by introducing a lowering operator that satisfies usual commutation relations you build a Fock space like this in the usual way. Okay. You know, if you're doing free theory, this would be e to the I k lambda, right? This would be the normal spatial wave function. Okay. Now, once you have this Fock space description, then it's a bit, and you have operators, because now what have you done? What we didn't have before was an operator that's labeled by a position lambda, okay? That's what you don't have in the first quantized point of view. But now you've constructed an operator that's labeled by lambda, which was the eigenvalue, okay? It's not, so this trick has sort of given us the space-time, okay? We have now some operators, a function of lambda, and then you can say, well, I construct the reduced density matrix associated to a region, lambda 1, lambda 2. And so some, I think quantum information people have an explicit formula for the reduced density matrix of free fermions in one dimension associated to a region. Okay, it's not trivial. Normally, you don't know the reduced density matrix, right? This is the reduced density matrix of a region lambda one, lambda two for any free fermion system, and it's given by the correlator. Okay, so this C is a matrix of the two-point function of the fermions, right? So you have fermions, they have a two-point function, that's that. You think of that as a matrix, you build another matrix H like this, and then you build an operator, these are like side daggers, and notice that we're integrating from lambda one to lambda two, so these are only operators in the region, right? Because you're integrating out everything else. And so this is an operator that acts on states that are in lambda one, lambda two. So the main point here is that there's an explicit formula for the density matrix, okay, which is not something that you normally have. But thanks to these people, we have it for free fermions. Okay? And it's given in terms of the correlators. Okay? Very good. So there are going to be three steps that we were fortunate that people have done in the last 10 years. Okay? So step one, these guys found the reduced density matrix. Okay? Step two, Klitsch and Levertov showed that you can express this matrix, the entanglement entropy that follows from this, so trace rho log rho of this matrix, it has an expansion in terms of cumulance, that just means connected endpoint functions, of the density operator. Okay, so the density operator shouldn't seem too crazy, okay? Because remember, the entanglement, this reduced density matrix depended on this correlator. This correlator at the same point is the density operator, okay? So the density is psi dagger lambda psi, right? Call that n. These are connected two-point functions, right? You take the two-point function in the region A minus the disconnected part, okay? So that's just the connected two-point function. And these guys showed, just manipulating the expression on the previous page, that you can express it as the sum over density fluctuations, okay? Actually, they were originally interested in, so there's been a lot of, you know, in condensed, as you probably know, a lot of people thinking about everything in terms of entanglement entropy these days, but people are bugged by the experiment. They want to measure it. How do you measure entanglement entropy? In the context of this Levertov paper, is they say, well, if you measure density fluctuations, it's a bit like measuring entanglement entropy. Okay, that was their motivation. So you have this expansion in terms of these cumulants. Okay, so that was useful fact number two. And by the way, density fluctuations are what everybody was calculating in the 90s in these papers, in this 2D string theory. So this starts to look good. But it's still an infinite series, right? So that looks tricky. And so, and there's the third result, this is from Timely, it's from 2 years ago. So Calabresi and the collaborators showed that in the WKB limits, where there's a large net, where, you know, that means that if you're on the top of the Fermi C and you look down, and there are a lot of fermions before you hit the bottom, okay? So it's a large occupation numbers. So in the WKB limits, it turns out that there's a leading log behavior. So as many of you might have known, you get logarithms in the entanglement entropy of fermions. And this singular logarithmic behavior only appears in the first term in this expansion. Okay, it's actually not, they do appear, like if you start calculating, V⁴ is like a sum of a bunch of terms. Like it's the, let me put it this way, the disconnected four-point function does have these logarithms, okay? It's just when you take all the combinations, they cancel, all right? There may be an easy way of seeing that, but I don't know it. So it turns out that there are non-trivial cancellations and the leading logarithm only appears in V2, all right? So thanks to those three results, now we're really in business because all we have to do to get the entanglement entropy is calculate the two-point function of the density fluctuations, which you can almost look up in papers in the 90s, okay? Although not quite. All right, that makes sense, right? So Ted, did that answer your question? Yeah, so we have these fermions, we have these eigenvalues, we wrote a second quantized description of the eigenvalues, and that means they're labeled by position, and then you know what you mean by a reduced density matrix of a region. And then that reduced density matrix, I've told you, is given by, in a leading WKB limit, is given by a two-point function of the density-density operator, which is a four-point function of the size, okay? And these size all have a little psi, a wave function in it. So basically, you end up having to calculate some integrals of four of these wave functions, all right? And what do the wave functions look like? Well, they're just WKB wave functions in an inverse harmonic oscillator potential. So they look like this, with P this being there. I'm sure you're all familiar with these kind of formulas. So you take four of these, and you have to do the integrals, okay? So you can do that, and you get this answer, okay? Plus some order one terms, all right? So it's, with the machinery developed, the final technical bit is pretty, you know, a lot of the works in this field are sort of technical tour de force. This is a, you know, it's just doing some relatively simple integrals. Good, okay, right, so, perfect. So the upshot was that in this particular theory at least, we use the entanglement entropy to see the emergent local physics of this tachyon from the matrix quantum mechanics. Furthermore, the locality goes down to the cutoff, okay, which is turned out to be a scale set by the string coupling constant, which was weak, okay, so it's a small scale. And the technical tool that we used to do this was the fact that it boils down to the fact that the reduced density matrix is known for free fermions, and then you just had to do some integrals of WKB wave functions. Mm-hmm. So just now to back out for a moment. So, you know, I sort of view this as a proof of concept, okay? It's certainly true that this single matrix quantum mechanics is much simpler than BFSS or even the next simplest thing, which I guess has two matrices or at least some off-diagonal modes. So this singlet sector, the single matrix quantum mechanics is too simple to access some of the deeper questions about sub-ADS scale locality. There isn't really a hierarchy of scales. Closely related to that, there are no genuine black holes in this theory, so there probably isn't something like it. This is not like the Ryu-Takinage entropy. This is more like the one-loop correction to the Ryu-Takinage entropy. It's the entropy of a scalar field propagating in the space-time, okay? However, hopefully it's a first step in a proof of concept towards unraveling the entanglement in more complicated matrix quantum mechanics. And a final comment is that a lot of you probably heard about MIRA and tensor networks and so on, and so that's a way of building sort of like the skeleton of the space, the scaffolding of the space-time. Okay, MIRA is a way of thinking about ADS scale locality. But if you want to get to sub-ADS scale locality, you're going to need to combine it with some large N physics, and maybe these kind of ideas are a useful way for thinking about that. So with those words, just happy birthday, Gary, again. It's been an honor to work with you and to be here.
So I thought in Susskind and Uglum, they argued that the entanglement entropy and string theory should be set by the Planck length rather than the string length.
And then
the dominant contribution came from the spheres, not from the tori. So do you see that in your...
Actually, that's good. So two things. So when I... Maybe I shouldn't have put up the Susskind argument. But firstly, the reason I put this up was not because they did an entanglement entropy and string theory thing, but because they were just talking about this interplay between quantum corrections and sort of the bulk of the space-time. This is all a leading order of large mu, which is sort of genus zero, you know, which is just the sphere. So I should say that we haven't thought very much about this way of thinking about the problem. And in fact, you know, because this theory is sort of solvable, you could hope to go away from this. Indeed, you could hope to go away from this large mu limit and then really just calculate some closed form exactly entanglement entropy in the theory, which would be a nice thing to do. But I think there's sort of, I mean, there isn't really a separate Planck length in the, I mean, the string coupling is the only. I mean, the Planck, there's no L Planck right in 2D. So yeah, that's probably part of it too. Was it?
Yeah, so this bosonic matrix quantum mechanics is unstable.
Yes.
And there's another version which
yes.
is stable. And the interesting question that comes up with respect to that is your calculation changed?
I wouldn't have thought so. But
it should be.
Okay, a lot.
Because there are two scalar fields.
Well,
in
then
that, case.
That would just be a factor of two, probably. Oh, yes, I can. Good. So let me say, yes, a few words about that. So here you see I only filled up half of the Fermi C.
Okay,
it's unstable.
So you would
and it
get another one from the other half. Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's almost a trivial thing. So if you look at this root 2, won't be, the normalization of the wave function changes because you integrate over both sides.
I see.
And
sure.
I think that will give you a factor of two, actually. It may be as stupid as that. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is probably related to Aaron's question. So if you're computing an entanglement entropy in space-time, you would have expected a 1 over g newton squared, or an e to the minus phi. And your answer is something that looks like a one-loop correction, so something that doesn't depend explicitly on g newton, or it has the log of g newton rather than g newton. I wonder whether that's related to the fact that this theory doesn't have black holes.
So that's sort of what I was trying to get at here. So the superposition of this part of this transparency and this transparency, they were connected in my mind at least. and so the idea is that if you have a more interesting matrix quantum mechanics that has off-diagonal modes and has string states in it, then you can think about this sort of a tree-level contribution to the entanglement entropy, which is roughly what Ryutaki-Nagy is. And I think this theory is just too simple to have that contribution. And so the space-time is not really doing much. It's just the background for this single field to propagate in. And so that's why the entanglement, you don't get this sort of more interesting contribution. But I would definitely expect in a more interesting theory there would be another contribution that should have a 1 over g newton in front, for sure.
This might be another version of the same question, but it's going to sound different. I'm certainly familiar with the fact that in a 1 plus 1 theory, the renormalized entropy corresponding to an interval is a log. But you know, for continuum field theory, to get that answer, you have to subtract off what's effectively a local counterterm at each endpoint, which is divergent.
What? I mean, you shouldn't, why do you think it, look, just put the thing on the lattice, okay?
Yeah.
That divergence will be the lattice spacing.
Right. Right. So okay. I would have thought you'd see some constant term. Oh, you say it's just it's because it.
I'm trying to say that there is a UV cutoff in the theory.
Yeah.
And it's set by the string coupling.
I see. And so I should just take the logarithm of that thing, and that's my.
This is a big number. This number is big. That's this GS of so mu.
I see.
So remember, mu was is the maximal value of the string coupling here.
Right.
And when mu is very big, the string coupling is small everywhere. Okay, and so this is a very interesting UV cutoff in this theory. I mean,
It's a question about these higher density correlators.
Yes.
They're basically down by 1/n relative to.
I
mean, since they're connected.
There's no. No, well, okay, so here's what, good, let me say a few things. So actually, these guys, they didn't prove this for every potential. They actually only proved it for fermions in a box and fermions with no potential. Mm-hmm. So we were, and the statement's the following, that they're not, they're only logarithmically down. So for example, there's certainly an order one number that corrects this. Mm-hmm. So you see, this is not, there's no n in front of this, right?
Right.
So this is only logarithmically large. And so there's an order one correction, and then there are 1/log corrections.
But in terms of this string coupling mu, right?
So only logs of that will appear. So in this expansion, exactly. So the leading term goes like log of this small number or big number. And then there's an order one correction, and then there's a 1/log of that big number correction.
I see.
So there may be a simple sort of large n counting that explains this, but I haven't quite understood that yet.
But basically, they're due to the interactions of tachyons, like.
Yes, well, of course, that's what these high order terms would be.
Right,
yes.
Right.
Yes.
Because we know that the CFT is only in the quadratic approximation where they're just free massless.
No, exactly. So I would be very interested to know if you go away from this large mu limit. You might be able to calculate, you should be able to calculate corrections, and that should teach you
there's
something.
Actually, for this model, there is a stronger statement, which is simpler in terms of fermions, because there is no scattering at all.
Yes,
like
right.
The fermions just are purely left moving on one side of the Fermi surface and purely right moving on the other side. So there may be some additional simplification.
Yeah, I would love to hear from people who know more about this theory than I do, it would be, maybe that's just a closed form answer for the entanglement entropy, and it's a function of mu, which would be pretty interesting, because
right.
It let you start to think about entanglement away from the classical gravity limit. Classical.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, okay.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Which is a stronger statement. Yeah, it's a stronger statement than.
Okay, I'd love to hear about.
We can discuss.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to let Steve get his question.
So this is probably a very naive question, but apart from the emergence of locality, do you get anything about the structure, the local structure from this? For example, is there any way of seeing that the tachyon lives on a half line and not a full line, or any further information than there's something that looks like locality?
So at zeroth order, no. And in fact, that's sort of part of the objective, is to get something simple, like without, I mean, of course, the circumstances where you could try to get Einstein, you know, a lot of people trying to derive Einstein's equation from entanglement and so on. I'm just trying to get something, so simplicity is part of the point. But it's true that, you get area. So if we were in higher dimension, this thing is, of course, the area of this. So you would start learning about the metric. I mean, one dimension is a bit too simple for this. But if there was a higher dimensional version of this, this divergence would come multiplied by length. So you would learn about lengths, for example, in the space-time. But it's local information. So things like a line versus a half line, I'm not sure, is so natural.
Mm-hmm. Last question. So you started with matrices, n by n matrices, and then you went to the eigenvalue picture. But when you do that, you pick up these Vandermonde determinants in your volume forms, and I'm just wondering what happened to them. It just seemed like...
So 1D, this is where 1D is very nice. So in 1D, and only in 1D, with a single matrix, these Vandermonde determinants are... it turned out they're equivalent to saying you have fermions. So you know, when you have a fermionic wave function, you have this sort
like
of
slater determinant.
They just become a slater determinant, yeah.
Okay, but...
So if you can just absorb them into the wave function, and all they do is anti-symmetrize your wave function. And so the Vandermonde determinant is very tractable in this case.
Okay.
Short question.
Yeah. Can you push this any further to get more information, like, say, about the mutual information between intervals or something like that?
Right, indeed. Those are, so I think that is tricky, actually. I mean, in principle, I have a closed form for the density matrix. So, you know, if you're willing to play around with raising and lowering operators for long enough, it might be there, but I have not seen papers. So I haven't seen papers in the free fermion literature about that, but in principle, it's certainly accessible. Yeah, let me put it this way. The information is in there somewhere.